Europe is at a turning point in its evolution. Its most recent attempt at a union is crumbling. Britain is departing. Russia, so recently crippled, is reopening East-West tensions. Most histories of Europe tend to be long, but Simon Jenkins has set himself the task of bringing this all together in a narrative whole. His personal account, A Short History of Europe from Pericles to Putin, guides us through the battlefields of warring tribes to a landscape of relative peace, wealth and freedom, twisting and turning from Greece and Rome through the Middle Ages, Renaissance, Reformation and Revolution to the turbulence of two world wars and onto the present day. It's in the new book, A Short History of Europe. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from the UK, Simon Jenkins. Simon, good morning. To you.
Good morning.
Well, I mean, to talk about setting yourself a task, a brief history of Europe, or a short history of Europe, where on earth do you begin and how do you, this is a continent unlike any other, Simon, how do you bring these into a whole?
Well, you just brought it into 30 seconds, I'm very impressed.
Yes, but I had the press notes, you see, so I'm ahead of the game.
I mean, what I was trying to do, I was trying literally, as the book says, to try and tell people who think they vaguely know a bit of European history just a little bit more without making them read 1,000 pages. It really is just 80,000 words. You can read it in an afternoon, I think. But I really wanted to try and grab at what Europe was about. It's not a history of the countries of Europe. It doesn't tell you about the history of France or Germany or Britain. It tells you the history, I hope, of what Europe has meant to people down the ages, as it's emerged from the classical period and the Dark Ages and so on to the present day. And it is an exercise in concision, but I just very carefully don't use anything or refer to anything that's not essential to the central narrative. It's a chronology of history.
And one of the things that I noticed, and you used the word Europe, and I'll hear some breaks here, sort of, I can hear the hackles going up at the mere mention of the word, but one of the things about Europe is the first thing that you see in the book is a fantastic selection of maps, pointing out that thing as Europe as a current, the way that the boundaries have changed with Europe, and the civilizations have changed, but the actual concept, has it really changed over the millennia?
The crucial change was after the Roman Empire, when it became a Christian empire, or Christendom it was called, and it embraced the whole shore of the Mediterranean. When the Muslims came in the 7th, 8th century and conquered Africa and the Levant and parts of Spain, Europe shrank at that point, but more or less to where it is today. So we know what Europe is. Europe embraces the continent solid as we know it, and also a teeny bit of Istanbul and most of Russia. Russia is a European country insofar as it plays a part in the great game of Europe. I have to say, I'm not sort of pro-European in that sense. I'm just trying to describe the continent because it is, I think, the most remarkable continent in world history.
And why do you think that is? Is it the fact that you had, if you like, Africa notwithstanding, the birthplace of Southeast Asia, the cradle, if you like, of civilization with the Greeks and the Romans and their influence on language and trade?
Well, I'm very careful about cradle of civilization. It's the cradle of European civilization. I'm a great admirer of Chinese, Indian, and Mesopotamian civilization. No, I mean the point about Europe, I think, and it's a genuine puzzle which I do try and discuss. Why was it that Europe, by the year 1900, ruled half the world? It was quite astonishing. It didn't just rule half the world, it exported its culture to half the world. Measurements, all these things globally are in European terms. English is the language of the world, really, still. And I think it has to do with being a maritime continent. It was essentially about trade, about ships, about sea battles. And it was that founded these great empires that dominated the 19th century, crumbled away in the 20th when we wasted it all on two world wars. But by the time they were over, it was undeniably the case that Europe, and of course her sort of sibling continent of North America, was dominant over world affairs. I mean, we may deplore it, but it's a fact.
And I mean, you're also not afraid to tackle the tricky subjects of religion and Christianity and how that was exported and how that shaped the history of Europe and beyond.
I mean, I think Christianity is more important than I'd expected it to be in the history of Europe. I don't think that applies in the rest of the world. I mean, the missionaries in South America and so on obviously were very important, but really Christianity remains an essentially European religion. Religion, of course, is a far more potent bonded together of peoples than wars and power is. So I don't rate Christianity all that highly. I do rate culture very highly. I think the fact that Chinese symphony orchestras spend their whole time playing European music is very interesting and significant. And the same applies in Latin America. It's the potency of European culture that fascinates me rather than the power of European arms and people.
And also, obviously, you look at that, you look at the European culture, we're looking at, obviously, at the Renaissance and the Reformation and the Restoration, presumably, with that, and that influence on all spheres of thinking and the complete man and all that derives from there.
Well, I mean, one thing that absolutely fascinates me and always will, I was a classicist originally, is how the beliefs and discussions and conversations of 5th and 4th century Athens so completely dominate what can only be described as liberal values the world over. Europe is the cradle of democracy. It's this place where people, however half-heartedly nowadays one might say, believe in popular representation and the legitimation of power and so on. And whenever you have battles anywhere else on the globe between rebels and power, the reference back is always to democratic principles that hail from Europe. And I just find that, impressive and significant. And to that extent, I'm a fan of Europe.
How did you go about picking out, if you like, I'll go to football parlance here, you know, your first 11 or even rugby, your first 15 of people who have, or figures who have helped shape Europe? Because this is a huge cast of characters when you look at Europe, from everybody from Caesar to Catherine de Medici to Merkel to Shakespeare, Picasso, Aristotle. I mean, how do you thin that down?
I basically tried to. Well, it's a book about power. It's not a book about. It's not a book about social history or economic history or feminist history or whatever. It's a book about the course of power in Europe, and it revolves around mostly the great central European states of France, fragmented Germany, Austria, Italy, and for a while Spain and Russia. The relatively small part played by the Scandinavians, even the British, and usually the Spanish and Portuguese. So you do have those people who occupied land and exerted power from Charlemagne right through the Holy Roman Empire to the great sort of titans of Louis XIV and Charles V and so on. These are the people who dominated power in Central Europe and determined the outcome of its great wars, because it's a story of almost relentless wars. And then, of course, you end up with the cataclysm of the 20th century, when everything we'd done to bind together the people of Europe after the Congress of Vienna and Napoleon, everything we'd done was dissipated in the lunacy of First and Second World War.
Is it difficult to write a history of Europe without being, because we are, you know, it is less than, just over 20 years since the end of the century, but without being focusing and being drawn to the 20th century and those two major conflicts and the rise and fall of fascism and communism as well? Is it difficult to not steer everything towards, if you like, the tail end of any history of Europe?
I think that's true. I mean, it would help if one knew what the next century was going to be like. I don't know if I do agree with that. I mean, I regard Europe as having built up to a sort of climax in the 19th century, and it led the Industrial Revolution and so on. It led world trade. I mean, 90% of world trade was in European hands in the 19th century. So it was a sort of climax of everything that had gone right back to the Greece and Rome, but right through, as you said before, the Renaissance and the Enlightenment, to what appeared to be an emergent sense of democracy in the 19th century. And then came this cataclysm. All I'll say is that you know, we have survived the cataclysm, and Europe is still the most extraordinary place. It's the place most people want to emigrate to. It's the place that tourism most prospers. It is still doing very well, even as we read the newspapers, and they all seem terribly gloomy.
You mentioned the word emigrate to or migrate to. The migration in Europe is not a 21st century phenomenon, is it? I mean, it's happened over the millennia in Europe as well.
Well, it's worth remembering that all Europe is composed of migrants from the Asian land bloc and to a certain extent the African one, but it's basically an immigrant continent. No, you're quite right. That said, there's absolutely no doubt that in the 20th century, this concept of great sort of continental movements of people has become more politically sensitive, let's put it that way, and will have to be confronted in some way. I can't see that any way of avoiding that. Europe's domestic population is declining. The rest of the world is bursting at its gates. It's just like Mexico and America. If you're rich, people want to come to your country. And I suppose in the very, very long term, Europe will change its character gradually as a result.
When you finish a work such as this, you know, everyone from Pericles to Putin, and you put down, I was going to say, your pen, or you press send on your computer, or whatever you do, do you leave Europe, if you like, at the moment as we stand, and having looked back through thousands of years of history, with a sense of positiveness towards the future, or did you just want to sort of crawl back underneath the duvet and put your head underneath the pillow and avoid it all?
It depended on what I had for breakfast. I pressed send and I kept on trying to recover. I can't predict the future. I really can't. As I said before, I'm a European admirer. I think to that extent, it's a pity that Britain is in some sense leaving, but we're not really leaving. And we've done it so many times before and rejoined. I'm not that worried about it. But I think Europe is a pretty wonderful place, and I'd rather live in Europe than almost anywhere else on Earth. And I think, frankly, most Europeans would. You don't get that sense you get when I've been in the Middle East and India and so on, of people longing to come to England. I just think Europe is a good place to be and has huge resources of defense against any recurrence of agony and pain and falling apart. So I'm basically an optimist about Europe. I really am, and I think we have a lot to teach the world, and we shouldn't be that humble about it either, because we're endlessly being told, you know, shut up about being European and be more open-minded about other cultures. Yes, I'm open-minded, but I refuse to say that Europe isn't a very remarkable place.
There's the hoary old saying that those who do not study history are doomed to repeat it, etc., etc. Do you think that, having studied this work, perhaps we won't be repeating the mistakes and the disasters of previous generations?
Well, I think probably we have learned. We haven't learned very well. The reason why I deplore the obsession with war, which is not, I'm afraid, an obsession I avoid in the book, is that if you hark back to war all the time, like on Remembrance Day, which I'm rather opposed to, you tend to remember the wrong things. You remember grievances, enemies, horrors, atrocities, and so on. You don't remember the better things in your enemy's nature. And I therefore think the trouble with reading history is you've got to read the right history, which involves knowing which bits of history to try and forget and put out of your mind and move forward. So history is a double-edged sword. It's a very dangerous thing. But not studying history at all has to be very dangerous. So I'm right with the saying.
When you go through the history of Europe, and this is a personal one, but do you have, because there is such a cast of characters, is there a European or a founder of Europe or a theologian in Europe or a philosopher in Europe that you think, you know, I'm rather fond of this individual? I mean, we've got everybody from Pericles to Attila to Frederick II, the de Medicis, William of Orange, Bismarck. I mean, is there, do you go, when you came to write this, you think, right, I'm going to give this character a little more time, linger a little longer on this particular character from European history?
Well, I try and give character sketches of people, you know, just one paragraph. But I mean, the people I'd like to have met. I'd like to have met Charlemagne. I think I'd like to have met Frederick the Fourth, not Frederick the Great. I'd certainly been intrigued to have an interview with Napoleon. Goodness knows what he thought he was up to, but I think he was towards the end mad, as many of these people were. Metternich was an extremely interesting statesman. And then the people I'd like to have a real talk to are the people who caused the 20th century troubles. They really were, maybe Asquith and Lloyd George and people like that who did sleep on the job in a sense. Let's get them all in one room and have a chat.
Right, just the perfect European dinner party guests then, basically.
The book is called A Short History of Europe, from Pericles to Putin, and what a figure to end on as well. Who knows what we're going to be seeing in the next... it's out now. It's published in Viking. It is out now. Simon, if people want to find out more about you or about the book itself, do you have a website yourself? I mean, how can people get in touch with you and find out more about it?
I sadly don't. I'm too old-fashioned. you get the book from Amazon very easily.
And it will be...
I write for The Guardian... once a week, so people can find me in The Guardian if they want to.
Absolutely. And of course the book will be available as well as a download on the TRE virtual bookshop. Only remains to be seen, Simon, having done the short history of Europe, and of course you've done previous as well with the short history of England, what's next in your sights, or are you going to go back to bed after that breakfast?
No, I'm in the middle of the next, which is the short history of London. But I want to do it's the short history of the buildings of London. Why London looks like it does. I mean, there are thousands of histories about Samuel Pepys and so on. But I'm trying to work out why London looks so different from Paris or Rome or Berlin. I mean, why does London look, frankly, a mess at the moment? But it's a rather glorious mess.
A rather glorious mess. I like that about London. And as it's changing, ever changing as we speak, by the time that comes out, London could look completely different.
I fear so, yes.
Simon Jenkins, author of A Short History of Europe, it's been a pleasure to speak to you this morning.
Thank you very much.